Abraham Alcoholic. My name's Brian. Really echoing here, huh? I want to thank Mike for asking me to come down and speak. I don't get out much at night anymore, so this is a gift. The big book says, share what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. You know, I'm going to share a little bit about my story. I don't never really know what I'm going to say. I have a story. We all have a story. If you're new to AA, how many people in here are under a year of sobriety? Raise your hand. All right. And the reason I ask that is, when I was new to AA, I had a tendency to compare my story to other people's story. Tendency to say, you know, well, I didn't do that, so maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And I know I can say that, and it doesn't matter if you're going to do it, you're going to do it, but the drama of my life has really nothing to do with my alcoholism. My alcoholism has everything to do with my inability to control my drinking once I start putting alcohol in my system. All the drama that happened, all the stuff that was peripheral stuff, was just a byproduct of the life I lived. In the home I was raised in, and we all have that. I was alcoholic. You know, if I really looked at it honestly, I was alcoholic back when I was 18, 19. I was drinking out of control. Many times I went to places to just knock that edge off, and found myself drinking to a blackout or puking all over myself, and then wondering the next day how that happened. But I didn't get sober. My sobriety date is March 6th of 1993. And the interesting thing about that date is, I don't remember my last drink because I didn't wake up on March 6th of that year to get sober. I had kind of resigned to the fact that I was going to die. I'd been in AA prior to that for about a year and 2 weeks. I had a year and 2 weeks of sobriety in AA, going to two meetings a day. And in the middle of a recovery ranch, living on a recovery ranch, talking nothing but recovery, two AA meetings a day in groups all during the day, and 2 weeks after I got my year chip, I drank. And for the next 3 months, I drank every day. After the second meeting, I'd go to a noontime meeting, and then I'd go to a 6 o'clock meeting, and in between I'd do big book meetings or step meetings or group therapy or whatever it was going on at the ranch. And then at 7 o'clock, right after that meeting, I'd beeline over to a buddy's house and I'd start drinking. And then I'd start smoking coke, and then I would come back around 3 o'clock in the morning and get up the next day and say, I'm not doing that, it's the last time I'm doing that. I'm just going to get honest and tell everybody that I've been drinking, and I did. The week of 1993, March 1st all the way through the 5th, I had given up and I was contemplating suicide. I was like, how am I going to kill myself? Or I was going to move to Phoenix. This was my other plan. I had two plans. One, I was going to kill myself. And the other one, I was going to move to Phoenix and rob banks. And the interesting thing about those two choices, I had already done both those, or tried to do both those, 9 years before. And that was a failure of both those endeavors. And so, for me to think that was a solution should just give you an idea of where my mental capacity was at the time. And what happened that morning, it was like any other morning. I was just got up, did my deal, went to the noontime meeting, came back, and I was going to go to a meeting that night, and two guys 12-stepped me. And it wasn't your typical 12-step. It wasn't like, you know, hey, we hear you got a problem. It was sit your ass down. We want to talk to you kind of stuff. And I'd been friends with these guys for a while. And one of them was like a brother to me. And his name was Max. And Max saved my life. You know, Max made my drinking his business. And I'll never forget it. I can never give him enough thanks. Max is out shooting dope somewhere in California now. I don't even know if he's alive. I try to get a hold of him. That's interesting. My son was born 3 months ago. His name is Max. And, I didn't name my son because of the guy who saved my life, but I can tell you it came into play because he really made my pain his business. He really put our friendship on the line. And he called me on the carpet and asked me questions like, so how long have you been sober? And I said things like I always said. I said, oh, I've been sober a year and 3 months and 2 days or whatever. And he said, no, really, how long have you been sober? A day, 2 days, maybe you're not even sober right now. And as I got more animated and I got to get up to leave, another guy came in and he sat me down. He said, just sit down and shut up, we want to talk to you. And Max had that look in his eyes, you know, the look of, you see it in AA a lot, you know, when you get to know people and you really start to connect, of he really loved me and he really knew I was going down the path. And he said, man, I love you, man, I don't want to see you die. And I don't know what it was, maybe I just had no more fight, but I just broke down and said, man, I can't stop. And I haven't had a drink or drug since that day. And both those guys went out to use within a year. One never, I don't know where he's ever coming back, and the other guy's just coming back. And I've been sober 13 years, so it's like, there's some magic in AA, and there's some stuff that goes on that I don't understand, but I'll be forever grateful for that. I'll tell you why I didn't drink, I mean, why I didn't stay sober. See, I came to AA, and I believed the lie that I think happens a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believed it because somebody told me it, and I don't think he tried to mislead me, but he told me the truth. He said, his truth, which was, he said, Brian, you got a drinking problem. You need to go to AA. And so I went to AA thinking I had a drinking problem. And the solution for that is not drinking. But that's not the solution for what I have. I have alcoholism. What happened for me was, I went crazy in AA not drinking and not living a spiritual life. I really went insane. So when I came back on March 6th, I went on a different path. I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version. I'm not going to get into the details about my life. I'll talk about my recovery, but you know, understand I'm an alcoholic. And I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in California. I grew up in a town called Stockton, California. If anyone's from California, you know I'm not bragging about it. It's no disrespect to my friends from Lewiston over here, but it's the Lewiston of California. Don't take offense to it, Mike. It really wasn't a pleasant place to grow up, but I learned a lot of things in that home. I learned a lot of, you know, my mom was a barroom drunk, and my mom, she was, just, and all my uncles were drinkers. Everybody was drunk. The only person in my family that wasn't a drunk was my oldest brother and my dad. You know, my mom, my brother that was 4 years older than me, he was a drunk, you know. I learned from the age of 10 to that I could steal bikes from school and sell them to my brother for $5 and the respect of his friends. So when you're 10 years old and you're making $5 and you're stealing bikes and you get the respect of the 14-year-olds, that's a big deal. And I carried that idea and that whole acceptance all the way up to going to the penitentiary when I was 21, even while I was doing time. I live in Hawaii. I never really wanted to steal bikes, but you know what? I like $5. That was good when you're 10 years old. Back early 70s, a lot of money. You get a lot of baseball cards in. And which is funny, I steal a bike and I go buy baseball cards and trade. What the, you know, like that's the mentality of what the home I grew up in. And I started smoking weed when I was about 11, and I started drinking when I was 12, and it wasn't a lot of consequences for that stuff. You know, I ran away from home for my first time when I was 12. Me and my brother stole a boat, and we tried to get it out of the canals and get to San Francisco Bay, and we, you know, we hit a sandbar. We ended up docking it, and you know, so there's a lot of stuff that happened. But I'll tell you what really was magical for me was what alcohol did for me, and getting high, but really alcohol. When I drank, you know, I'm 5'1". I've been the shortest of my every class picture I've ever been in. There ain't no one smaller than me. Even the girls were taller than me. So when you're raised, when you grow up like that, you always feel like you're less than anyone. You know, I did. I always felt like I wasn't man enough. And so, like, if everybody's saying, well, we're going to break into the school, but who's going to climb through the window? You know, I'm the guy. I'll climb through the window. You know, who's going to throw a rock at that guy and hit him in the head? You know, I'll do that. You know, I mean, that's just because, like, and then I'd run, and my friends would come in and protect me. It was like looking for the respect of others through really messed up ways. And alcohol, the magic of alcohol, It changed my perception of everything, of who I was, how I felt, how I saw other people, how I thought they saw me. I felt like this was such an angry, violent world. And part of the environment I grew up in was that way. But when I would go to a party and start drinking, I felt like it was just more, everything was okay then. You know, there was a sense of peace around. And everybody was a little bit calmer, and I could talk better. And I know I grew at least 6 inches. Sometimes, if I had the right mix, I could grow 8, 9 inches, you know. And the problem is, you know, you're still only 5'1", 105, so you got to be careful. But that was the magic of alcohol. So the idea of giving it up never even entered into my mind. And I hid my alcohol, and a lot of young guys do this, and I'm not pointing young people out, but I know for me as a young man, I did this, is I hid my alcoholism behind my drug addiction. You know, because when I was 21, you know, from the age of 18, 19, 20, I started doing coke. And I started understanding that if you really are painting houses making $7 an hour and you're smoking as much coke as I was, they don't match up. You know, like a paycheck is $250 and that's gone that weekend, you know, and so you got to start finding other ways to supplement that. And, but I was a drunk. I was drinking daily from the time I was 18. 1980, I was a daily drinker. And I was a daily drinker because I moved out of my house. I graduated from high school. I moved out, moved in with four guys, and we got a house. And that was it. I became a daily drinker. And it was only because it wasn't like I had to drink, or at least I didn't think I had to drink. It was because I could drink. There was no one around. And I ran with people who drank and partied like I drank and partied. So I had nothing to compare it to. You know, I didn't have like somebody drinking socially over here and like, wow, you know, they don't do what I do. I ran with guys who were drunks, and so we all looked at each other like, we're okay. And we're getting evicted 6 months later, but we're all right. You know? It's a misunderstanding, you know? So I started dealing coke. I became a dealer. That was another thing. That was tied into me being, you know, like understanding that the status that, okay, well, I can't really get women because, you know, it's like when you hang around guys and they're all 5'10". You know, who's going to date the 5'1" guy, right? I mean, so, hey, you know what? If you're dealing coke and you got money and you got a bag, you can get girlfriends. And so and also the respect. So that's what I did. And the problem is, this is a failed business plan. If you're if you're using the substance that you're selling, it's destined for failure. But I'm good. I'm telling you, I have a way of convincing people that your money will be coming next week. I look right in the eye, man. You know what? I know I owe you $2,000. And you know what? But I got a lot of stuff fronted out, and I got stuff coming in. Just give me one more. I'll get you covered on the back end. We're all set. Okay, man. You know, I ran through a bunch of drug dealers in Tucson, Arizona. And got to a place at the age of 21 where it was checkout time. You know, it was like, everybody gets to that place. I'm surprised how much we don't talk about suicide in AA. At least some rooms. Like, it's a shameful thing. But I can guarantee you, I've sponsored a lot of guys, and most guys I've sponsored have attempted suicide at one time or another. And at the age of 21, it was my turn. You know? And I'm going to tell you right now, if you looked at my life, I had a beautiful girl. I had, you know, a job, and my boss was addicted to cocaine, so I get a lot of free hours. I lived in a decent house, and I had money sometimes. Sometimes I didn't. But outside, it wasn't that bad. And one night I'm sitting around, I'm looking at my life, the real life, not the facade that I want everybody to see, but really what's inside my heart. Everybody was gone, and I'm realizing that man, the game is over. And I remember, I'll tell a story just because it's goofy and it just describes accurately who I really am. I sit around with a buddy of mine named Dave Kerr, and Dave Kerr and I, we were partiers, we smoked a lot of coke, we drank a lot together. And I turned to Dave and said, Dave, I said, I need some money. And he says, I need some money. I said, well, I got a plan. Let's go rob that Kentucky Fried Chicken down the road. Dave's like, see, I guess he didn't have a better plan because he went with me. And I remember, because my car wasn't working at the time, getting in his car. It was AC/DC Back in Black had just come out. I think we even had it on 8-track, but I think it came out, and we were jamming to it, and we were like all pumped up, ready to do this. We had masks and ropes and guns, and we were like, taking them out. And we went in there. We ended up going in there and buying like a 3-piece meal. So I, you know, it's like, I'm not a gangster, that's for sure. So that night I dropped David off and I went out to kill myself. And I talk about this because I think it's really important to know that I was out there to do it. I wasn't out there to just play games, to get caught, you know, so somebody would feel sorry for me. I was not a self-pity kind of drunk. I wasn't one of those guys who cried in my beer. I was I was either really happy and having a great time or I was punching holes in walls. I mean, that's the two things I went to. And at this time, I was just done. I cut a piece of hose off, took my roommate's car, drove out, and I remember, even when I smell fumes today, even today, and it's been at least 24 years, 20, at least 23 years since this happened, I can still remember being in the car while those fumes are flowing through there, thinking, I got no reason to live. 21 years old. I mean, you're just starting life, man. And I was like ready to go. I was an old man at 21 today. I was so old. And the only thing that saved me was a conscience that I hadn't had since I was 10 years old. I had lost feelings of everything. At 10 years old, I got molested by a family member. And from that time on, from the age of 10 to at least this moment, I had like lost all consciousness about like caring about anybody, only about myself, what I can get out of life, not getting close to people, not trusting people. And that night, as I was writing letters to my mom about how sorry I was and that, you know, I'm sorry I had to do this, but I can't live anymore. Couldn't do it, man. Couldn't do it. I just could not. You know, my mother had already had it, buried one son. And my brother Chucky died when he was 7, leukemia. And I watched what that did to my family. I watched, you know, I was 5, Chucky was 7. I watched how that destroyed my mom and my dad. How my mom's strength became like overwhelmingly powerful. And so I didn't kill myself. And that's obvious, I know, but I figured I'd share that with you just in case you thought. But I made a decision that night, which is one of my problems in my mind, is I kind of figure out the wrong solution. And it's always because I got the wrong problem. And see, you got to know what the problem is before you can really fix it. That's why I think it's really important in AA, when you take guys through the book, to really find out, am I really an alcoholic? Am I really powerless over alcohol? You know, or am I cluttered? What am I? What's my problem? Well, my problem at this time was that I just didn't have enough money. Lack of funds. No money. No money. I need money. Right? It's obvious to me. It's not that I'm smoking coke, robbing from drug dealers, taking my roommate's rent. You know, it's not, none of that. The problem is I don't have enough money. If I had enough money, all my problems would go away. And what happened is the symptoms would have gone away. Everything would have looked good, but it would have been the same thing. And so, next day I drove into town and just robbed the bank. That's what I did. Went in there, robbed it, asked for the money, left. I'm not going to tell you how much I got, because Dave keeps telling me I shouldn't tell this story because you guys will start thinking I'm a real gangster. But I got $50 in my first bank robbery. Yeah, I got 50 because I asked for 50. So, you know, I got what I asked for. Don't ask me why I was in a sober blackout. You know. But I got my $50. And I'll never forget, like, thinking that. At first I was scared to death, you know, 21-year-old kid. I couldn't even shave at this time, you know. I mean, in fact, when they wrote the newspaper the next day, they said, 17-year-old kid robs 2 banks. But, because what happened, I had my $50, went and bought a 12-pack of Budweiser. And I drank 4 of them real quick, man. I felt, got that sense of ease and comfort. Got, okay. All right. Shit. $50. Drove across town. I robbed another bank. And then I got all the money I wanted. You know, I got a lot of money and I paid all my debts off and I just started this lie. 6 months later, I ran out of money, tell my boss, hey, you know, I need the van. I got to go into town, get some stuff. Gives me the keys to his van. I drive into town, rob a bank, go back to the job site. Like nothing happens. It was like I became addicted to it. Like, oh, okay, cool. You know, they don't know who I am. No big deal. When I run out of money, They gave me a license to do whatever I wanted to do. And 2 weeks after that, I got arrested. And we're doing time. And we used to always make, you didn't get arrested. You got saved. That was a running joke, right? I mean, not, but one of the truth was, I was one of those guys. I'd say that in a heartbeat. You know, we'd be playing, you know, spades or peanut or whatever we'd be playing and talking crap. And I'm like, man, you were saved. But I was saved. I'm going to tell you right now. If I had got caught, I don't think I'd be here today. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Now, you couldn't have convinced me that when they arrested me, or even for years later, but sitting here today, it saved my life. It saved my life. And my parents bailed me out. My parents loved me. You know, I'm a baby. My mom already lost one son, you know. I got a good family, you know. And they came and got me, and they got me a lawyer. And the lawyer told me the truth, which I needed to hear, which is you're going to prison. You can't rob three banks and not go to prison. It's going to happen. You got to do it. The only thing is how much you're going to get. You know, I hadn't really had any records since I was an adult, juvenile stuff, but that stuff was gone, you know. And 2 weeks, well, about 2 or 3 weeks before I was supposed to go to trial, I robbed another bank. So that's the overview of my insanity, you know. And the day I did that, I mean, I used to hang with this guy named Johnny Valenzuela. We were drug dealers together, and I used to have a lot of resentments against him because he slept with my girlfriend when I went to prison. But Johnny was a good friend. I remember sitting there saying, and we're all baked. We got home from work, you know, we're like, the bong's out. We're like, you know, we're feeling good. And I say, hey, I got to go to the bank to cash some checks. Can I have your car? And he throws me the keys to his car. And I go and rob this bank. And I did it on a Friday afternoon. Knowing I'm going to get caught. But guess what I'm going to do that weekend? I'm going to have a party. See, my lawyer told me you're going to prison. So if I go to prison, and you're 21 years old, and you're thinking of 10 years in prison, that's forever, man. That's like, my life is over. I mean, 30 years old was like dead, as far as I was concerned. 30. I mean, I'll be 44 on Sunday, and I'm thinking, 50's young, man. But back then, 30 was nothing. I mean, I was like, I couldn't even believe being 30, you know. And so I'm thinking, my life is over. And I robbed this bank. I knew I was going to get caught. I didn't get caught during Akron. I knew they're going to look at the tape. I mean, how many guys are out there on bond that are 5'1"? and that when the camera can't see the top of your head as you're leaving the bank, you know, that's like the truth. You know? So they came and got me. And I wasn't to get out. I didn't get out for the next 6 years. And there's nothing exciting that happened in prison. I drank in prison. My alcoholism continued with me, you know. It was the same way. I didn't fit in, you know. When you're 5'1", 105 pounds, and you know, from the suburbs, and you're going to federal penitentiary, it's like, I'll figure out how to fit in. So I became what other people want me to become. I became a racist, right? Not proud of that. Never had a racist bone in my body. But guess what? Some of the racists that I hung with protected me. So that's what I became, right? Did a lot of things I'm not proud of, right? Hurt a lot of people I didn't want to hurt. Lived a life I didn't want to live. To survive in a world I never wanted to be. It's just where it is. I'm not proud of it. I don't regret it. I wouldn't do it again if I had the choice. But that's the life that my alcoholism took me. And I got out. I was 28 years old, and I wasn't supposed to drink. I wasn't supposed to drug. And I had a year where I had about 8 months of parole, and then I had 5 years probation, ran wild, running consecutive. And so they're fed, we're going to have me for a while. And I was really mad that I couldn't drink. I'm 28 years old. Man, I don't have a drinking problem. I mean, sure, I shouldn't be using cocaine. I mean, that causes problems, but drinking? And I remember asking my professor, so you say I can't have any booze at all? He said, no drinking. It's part of your conditions of your release. So here's a clue for me. And I didn't take it, but here's a clue if any of you guys are on parole and you're drinking and you're not supposed to. A normal drinker, if they're told, okay, while you're on parole, you can't drink. And if you do drink, you will lose your freedom. Well, a normal drinker says, okay, I won't drink. Because I can take it or leave it. I couldn't take it or leave it. My mind convinced me, like, who is he to tell me I can't drink? It's a legal substance. And so I drank. And of course, I got caught. And of course, I went back to prison. And the lie I told myself then was, my poor officer's an asshole. He had it out for me, and he sent me back to the penitentiary. And the reality is, my parole officer was just doing his job. He's actually very kind to me. And I sent myself back to penitentiary. But I couldn't see that truth until I started to go through my inventory process. I couldn't see that truth until I started living the spiritual path. I was incapable of seeing the reality of my life. Just couldn't see it. So I went back to another 12 months, and everything changed. This is like my whole life kind of stopped, because up until that time, my parents, my mom and dad, I did time in Milan, Michigan, and Terre Haute, Indiana. And so that's pretty far away when I grew up in Tucson. And so my parents would fly out and visit me. My grandmother would come, my brother would fly in and visit me. They'd send me money orders so I could get commissary. They would take care of me while I was doing time, right? Well, guess what? The only letter I got this last stint was from a letter from my mom saying, "We're done. You ain't welcome here anymore. When you get out, your stuff's in storage and you have to live on the streets because we're not taking you. You won't get any more money orders. And I love you too much to watch you die." And the lie I told myself then was, my mom's, evil. I said another word, but that's what I said, like, that's what I meant. Like, how dare her disown her baby, And I thought it was a lie. A year later, I started to get released, and they asked me for my parole plan. I said the same thing I'd always said. Well, I'm going to go live with my parents, and my dad's got a friend who'll give me a job, and my caseworker said, "Well, you know what? I talked to your parents, and you're not welcome home." And that was like, that was like a reality check. And so I had to go live basically on the streets. I became homeless. I had $60 gate money. I was 29 years old. I had no job skills. I had no family members who wanted anything to do with me. Even my drunk brother didn't want me in his house. Couldn't go to any of my youth buddies because my parole officer would have been coming over. So I go live in this halfway house downtown Tucson. And I was mad. I was so mad. And I've been mad for a while. I was really pissed. And major chip on my shoulder. And they told me the very first day I got here, they said, "Okay, Brian, you're going to be here for 4 months. Here's the rules. Anytime you leave these premises and you come back on these premises, you're subject to a breathalyzer or a urinalysis. If you fail either one of those, we will send you back to prison." I already spent 7 years. I mean, from 22 to 29, I was done. I was like, man, I'm tired of getting tired. I mean, my life had passed me on. All my friends were married and careers and kids. I'm living in some crappy old halfway house downtown Tucson with no money, no respect, no skills, no hope. And they tell me I can't drink. So I'm like, okay, I won't drink. 4 months, I can do that. Third day out, I'm like, third day out, $60, that's all I got to my name. Somehow my mind convinces me, hey, you deserve it. You've been in prison for a year, dude. You deserve to drink. Who are they to say you can't drink? You don't got to drink a problem. Dude, a couple drinks ain't going to be bad. Come on. So I drank. And see, here's another lie I always tell myself. Because I controlled it that day, right? Oh, then I have a problem. The big book says, the obsession, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is to control and enjoy his drinking. You don't match those two things up. If you can control and enjoy your drinking, well, you may not be alcoholic. See, I could control it at certain times, but I never enjoyed it when I was controlling it. Never. And any time that I was enjoying it, I can guarantee I wasn't controlling it. That's a guarantee. And so what happened for me was I didn't get drunk that day. I got a few good, got some good stuff going in. I felt good. All right, man, life's starting to come together, man. The puzzle's starting to work. I'm going to get a job. Maybe I'll win the lottery. Things will happen. I'll find me a girl. Girls are hanging out in this park. I know. So, next day, same thing. No problem. Third day, guess what? My mind starts thought. Dude, it's Friday night. Go back to the halfway house, man. Bring some tequila. They got the weak staff on. They don't have the normal staff. The rookies are on tonight, man. You can go. You don't want to go back without booze. Go back. Come on, drink. So I bring a bottle of tequila on premises. And I get drunk. And of course, there's 50 people in recovery. They're all guys are doing time, getting out of prison, going to prison, whatever. Somebody told on me. Right? That's my theory, Somebody told on me. That's my problem. When I wake up next day, somebody told on me. Problem. I didn't share it with the right person. I know they were jealous. Me stumbling down the walkway to my room had nothing to do with it. So Monday comes around, my parole officer calls me up and says, Brian Percott's to the front lobby. And I go up there with all my little cosmetics, because I know I'm doing time. I got my toothpaste. I got like two or three things of toothpaste, my soap, my shampoo. You gotta look good in prison. You know, you never know whether, how far you'll be away from that stuff. So I got a little bag and I walk in there and he says, hey, have a seat. He says, what's that? I said, that's just some of my stuff I'm bringing back. Bring it back, where are you going? I said, why aren't you violating? And this asshole parole officer that I thought was a jerk sat me down and told me he did something that nobody had done. Maybe somebody had done it, but for some reason I was able to hear it. He said, you know what? Let me have a talk with you. He said, you know something, Brian? Let me tell you something. I've been in AA for 7 years. So that's the first thing he did. He broke his anonymity. He said, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years. He says, you keep thinking that drugs are your problem. He says, but you got a drinking problem. You can't not drink. But that's a problem. He said, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you one favor. It's the last favor you'll ever see me. This is a guy who violated me a year before. Or I helped violate me. He said, here it is. I'm going to make sure... I'm going to recommend your probation. You don't go back to prison because it's not going to do anything. It's not going to fix you. After 7 years, go back for 4 months. To think that's going to fix you is ludicrous. He says, I'm going to send you to AA. And you got to go to an AA meeting every day while you're here. And you got to get a job within 15 days. In the 4 months you're here, if you don't get any tickets, you don't get any write-ups, and you do AA meeting every day, then you'll be off. You'll be all set. He says, you make one slip up, I'm sending you back. Wash my hands. That man saved my life. He sent me to you people. I mean, I didn't want to come to see you guys. AA. I mean, 30 years old. AA? I was 29 at that time. I didn't even feel like, please. AA, for alcoholics, man. That's the people I was drinking without the park, man. People living on Skid Row. Oh, I lived... You know, my first week of sobriety, I had to sell blood. I'll never forget the arrogance. This is how arrogant I am. Now, I'm a week sober. I just got saved by my parole officer. I have no money. Oh, yeah, I'm running out of money. And I see an ad in the paper for first-time donations, right? $25. Plasma. You got to sell plasma. You can't sell blood. You're going to sell plasma because you can do it more than blood. So I go and sell plasma. And I'm sitting there in line with all the other street guys, right, and women. You know, next. And I'm judging everybody. I'm like, loser. That's a loser. And the whole time I'm praying I weigh 110, because you gotta be 110 to be able to get plasma. So I'm like, man, I hope I tip that scale. So I got caught, so I stole my plasma, you know. I made my money. And I come to AA, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, I really did. Even though I would never have told you that, I sat in the back. I had that pissed off look that newcomers get that are trying to be tough, right? Sat out there, don't touch me, don't, definitely don't hug me. Right? Don't trust anybody, because if you hug me, I know you want something from me. I don't know what I had. I mean, I was living in a half hour, I was thinking of busting meetings, but somehow I knew I had something that you wanted. But there's a few guys at the meeting that I still stay in contact with that broke the barrier, man. They just kept coming at me with love. And love. And I'm going to tell you right now, when you live in a world of hate, like I live in a world of hate, love is some powerful stuff, man. Love is really powerful. The kindness of another man. Don't ever underestimate reaching your hand out to a guy who looks pissed off. Because I'm going to tell you right now, most of them really want someone to talk to. It's a facade. You know, I was so scared. And they knew it. They knew it, man. They reached out and they touched me, man. I'll never forget, sitting at the bus stop. It's 110 degrees. I got 18 cups of coffee because that's what you do when you're new. Drink lots of coffee. I wonder why you can't sleep at night, right? Sweat pouring out of me, and I'm sitting at this bus stop, and it's really hot. And this guy drives up. He's got the air conditioning on, you know. And it's all like, it's like almost frosty inside this guy's car. Rolls the window down. Hey, you want to ride back to the halfway house? I'm like, nah, I'm cool. I got this. You know, I cannot accept the kindness of another man. You know, like, what's up with that? I could accept it. And I would have been helping him more than he would help me. The whole time there, I'd have been freaking out. What does he want? You know, is he gay? You know, my mind. Where my mind will go? We'll go places, you know. But eventually it got beat down. Eventually I started to fall. I moved away from the back to the front. I used to go play pool with these guys. They'd say, hey, we're going to go out for lunch and then we'll go play some pool. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I didn't know what to talk about. Early recovery, what do you talk about? You know, like, I don't know how to have a conversation. I had nothing to talk about. Like, yeah, okay, coffee's good. You know, I was like so scared to have a conversation with people. And they knew it. They didn't force anything on me, man. They really just were kind. So I came, and I thought, and here's what happened. I went to this noontime meeting. There's about 40 people. About 15 over here were talking about recovery, going through the 12 steps, good relationship with God, making amends, right? 4-step inventory. They were talking about real substance. And another group over here, with equal amount of sobriety, time-wise, they were talking about, you just don't drink when your ass falls off, you just show up no matter what, right? And these people over here were judging everybody. And when you're new, and you owe a lot of money because you stole a lot of money, and you don't want to do anything about those amends, right? You definitely don't want to do no inventory in my life, because I'm just all right. I ain't hanging with these guys. Like, they were way too intense for me, right? Because they're the ones smiling, laughing, having a good time. But I kind of drifted over to these guys, and I hung out with these guys. And anytime someone talked about God, I'd get up and leave me. Don't know why. I mean, I know why. I had deep resentments against God. But didn't want to hear any of that stuff. Anyone talk about 4-step, I didn't want anything to do with that. And so I fell in tune with a group of people who were not drinking, seemingly were doing okay, and able to have some fun, like sleep around with each other, you know, do that stuff, you know, cut corners. And I did that for a year and 2 weeks together. And I didn't do the recovery process. I didn't want anything to do with the recovery process. I didn't even know I was alcoholic. They came around the room and said that, and I said, it was like I was a duck. Yeah, quack. If you'd asked me, if you'd have come up to me and said, so, you're alcoholic? This is what my sponsor did. When I finally got a sponsor, who was a big book, what's funny is I went, after I drank and got sober on that day, I knew I had to go to those group of guys. I knew I had to go there. I didn't want to. It wasn't like I was skipping over to hang out with these guys that were, you know, doing this stuff. But I knew that there was no choice. I had no choice. It was like the game was over. So I went and asked this guy, Cowboy Kane. And he was the guy I disliked the least, put it that way. On the dislike level, he was probably at the bottom. And so I went and asked Kenny to sponsor me. I said, I need help, man. I'm 2 days sober, man. He said, you know what, I'd love to help you. I've been watching you for a year. You know what, this will be great. He says, do you have a big book? I said, no. He said, well, here's a big book. Gave me a big book. Gave me some pages where he said, I want you to read page 84 to 88. I want you to read that every day until I can come and see you this Thursday. This is like a Sunday night, so he's going to come and see me on Thursday. He's going to come and see me, visit me at this recovery ranch. I was done fighting. He asked me if I believed in God. I said, I hate God. He said, well, that means you believe, so that's good. Right? There's a belief there, right? I mean, so even if you hate God, then you're believing. At least I'm not a non-believer. He said, all right, well, we can work with that. He says, you don't have to like God, because you don't even know God. But I'm going to give you some prayers. And so he gave me some basic directions. And then he came and saw me on that Thursday. I'll never forget the conversation. He said, so are you alcoholic? And I said, oh yeah, I'm alcoholic. He said, well, why are you alcoholic? How do you know you're alcoholic? And I'm like such an ass that I start giving some, like, something I heard in the rehab. You know, about, I don't know, I was talking somewhere. And he shut me down. He said, you know what, stop. He said, let's just assume you don't know why you're alcoholic. Because you really don't. Let's just start from the very first step. And let's walk through this process. Because that's what I'm, if you want me to sponsor you, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to be your maid or your, you know, I'm not going to be your driver. I'm just going to be a guy who's going to guide you through this process. I'll introduce you to a God of the understanding. He says, these steps, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, he says, that's what will happen. You will be awakened spiritually and the obsession to drink alcohol will be removed. Would that be wonderful? See, my first year in AA, I thought about drinking all the time. You know, but if you go to enough meetings, you kind of get squashed because you're hearing all the drama, and you're, especially when you're in a recovery range. Everybody's new in rehab, you know, it's like, but I thought about drinking all the time. See, it's not, here's the thing, this is what's true for me. It's not the first drink that gets you drunk. That's what we say in AA. It's always a cute phrase. It's the first drink that'll get you drunk. But here's what'll get you drunk. the unprotected thought that precedes the first drink. Alright? That's what's going to get you drunk. Alright? The first drink happens after that. I never had protection against that first thought. Now, my protection was meetings and hanging out with people, but eventually, human resources, they wore out. And all reasons for not drinking were pushed aside for the insane idea that I could drink safely. And I think when you're going to 2A meetings, living on a recovery ranch, doing groups during the day, and you're still drinking at night, that's a problem. Like, that's not just social drinking. That's a problem. And he taught me, he said, I will give you tools so you can have some power in your life so you won't be powerless around. Now that was like heresy. You know, that's like, whoa, wait a minute, we're always powerless. No, he said, this is about getting power. Physically, you will always be powerless around alcohol. But this is about being powerful, getting power. Well, not going to be from you or your group or your sponsor, your girlfriend, your wife, your kids. It'll be from a power greater than yourself. And he guided me through that process. And I'm going to tell you right now, I was a skeptic. I was a doubter. I was anti-God. But I had no more answers. I was done fighting. The surrender was there, man. I was surrendered. I was beat. I mean, the big book talks about some of these we balk. I did balk, but it was very, very short balk for me. Because I'm not a guy who suffers well emotionally. I just don't suffer well. My whole life, man, if I feel uncomfortable, I know what will fix that. It'll be a drink. It'll be a fatty that the guy passes me next to me. It'll be anything that makes me not feel. So I don't, I'm like that. My problem is I don't... Sobriety sucks. That's my problem. Without a spiritual solution, sobriety is painful. For a guy like me, it's just not comfortable. And here's the type of guy I used to drink. Hey, Brian, we're going to a party. Right away, I started getting anxious. Well, whose party? Oh, Renee's having a party. Oh, how many people? Oh, there'll probably be 50 people there. Oh, really? When are we going? We're going in an hour. Well, I better go get drunk, because if I don't go, I won't go to the party. I gotta go to the party sober. You know, I get nice and lubricated, and then I can slide into the party. Because if I walk in sober, everybody's looking at me, I'm all freaked out. That's just the way I am, you know? So I gotta learn how to live a way that I'm comfortable being sober. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are magical, you know? And I walk through those begrudgingly. I tell you, some of the key things that really shaped and my foundation changed my life. The fourth step, I come from a sponsorship that's straight out of the big book. It's big book sponsorship, right? They don't have any forms or anything like that. It's like, let's just follow the rest, right? We do four column resentment inventory. We do a fear inventory. We do a sex inventory. And when you all written out, you go and you share it with your sponsor. Everything. And all the secrets that I did write down, I share it all. Lay it all out. Get on this. This is who I am. Alright? Because my sponsor was slick enough. After I did that, here's a few ones. The guy who molested me had deep-seated resentments. And I remember when I was doing my fourth column, they call them turnarounds, fourth column. It doesn't matter. I'm looking at where, you know, where am I to blame. Right? And you're like, I'm 10 years old. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay. Like, you know, screw this guy. So I call my sponsor, I'm mad as hell. I'm like, dude, first off, I understand where you're coming from, but I was 10 years old. 10 years old, man. I didn't know part in that. He said, oh, really? Yeah. So you're probably right. He said, how old are you now? 30? I said, wow. He said, so for 20 years, you allow this guy to continue to hurt you. When are you going to get to a place of forgiveness? He said, Brian, if you ever really wish to be free, you're going to have to forgive this man. And I'm thinking, how can I forgive this? It's an unforgivable act. He says, well, you're right, you can't forgive. But God can help you forgive. He says, you want to be free? I said, no, I want to be free more than you imagine. He said, all right. Because see, here's a lie about freedom. I always thought, well, they open the gates and let me out, I'm free. And I was in jail way before I went to prison. And I was in prison way after they let me out of prison. I'd never been free until I walked through this path. So I learned to forgive. I took it into prayer and learned to forgive the man. And here's a kicker. I thought, well, I do this cute little inventory, and then I pray to God and say, okay, I forgive this man. Well, here's what happened years later. Now, I'm talking, I'm in Maine. I'm doing, taking guys to the steps over at Maine State Prison. Guy comes up to me and says, hey, he says, I really like what you're doing with these guys. I really think that, you know, this is an inmate saying, these guys are really, everything's really cool, man. Really, can you take me through the 12 steps? And I know this guy's crying. See, I know he's got a crime against kids. And I didn't say yes. I didn't say yes, I'd love to help you. I said, I'll have to get back to him next week. I'm so ashamed of that. I'm really ashamed of that. And I remember going out to my car and crying. And thinking, what is wrong with me? Everything that my sponsor and everybody that my heroes of AA taught me that, and my real purpose in life is to be a maximum service to God and my fellows. And here is one of God's children put in my path, and I totally said, I'll have to get back to you. And I called my sponsor up, and I told him what happened. I said, yeah, and I have a great sponsor. He doesn't bash me. When he knows he doesn't need to be hard, he's not hard. He said, yeah, that sucks, huh? I said, so what are you going to do? I said, I got to help this guy. He said, yeah, that's probably right. So I went back in the next week and I told this guy, sponsor him, I'd take him to the 12 steps. Now here's the magic. As a result of me walking this man through this process, I got free of the last piece of resentment that I was holding on to. You see, if I didn't have any resentment, I would have just said, yeah, I'd love to help you. But the fact that I had to walk for him, and by me, just by the gift of God being allowed to walk this man through the process, I understood that though I may have an issue with the crime, I have no issue with the man attached to it. I harbor no ill feelings, no judgment. Now, of my own power, I can't get there. All right? That's the gift, you know, being of service. And this other one against my mom was very important for me, and it still is today. And especially as my mom gets older, and I don't get to see her nearly as much, but, you know, my mom had to disown me. And I think that the reality of that is that I made my mom do that. And I never understood the impact of that. Even when I was doing my turnaround, even when I was looking at my part in that resentment against my mom for kicking me to the streets, even when I looked at that, the truth was, I put the pen in my mom's hand, I made her do that. Even when I made amends to my mom, when I had to sit down face to face and say, Mom, I need to talk to you. We need to chat. And I told her, I said, you know, Mom, I don't know how I'll ever be able to repay the damage I've done. But I know for a fact that you did everything in your best, you did the best job ever to raise me. And the problems I had are my problems. They have nothing to do with you. And I'm truly sorry for making you have to write that letter. And I was guided through this process in a way when you're doing amends to let people, ask people, is there anything that you want to share? Is there anything else that you would want to share with me? And then shut up and listen to what they have to say. And I asked my mom that. She said, yeah, I'd like to talk to you about that. She said, you know, Brian, no, we're not saying this, we're crying. And she said, you know, Brian, she said, you know, writing you that letter was harder than burying Chucky. And I'm like, I don't want to hear that. She had to bury her boy who was 7 years old. And she just told me that writing me that letter was harder than burying Chucky. And that just hit me, man. I was like, oh, man. And I asked her, like, why? And she said, you know, with Chucky, I had no choice. Leukemia took him. Like, it was a done deal. But with you, I didn't have to write you that letter. I had a choice to whether to do it or not. And having to do that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. So when they talk about selfishness being the root of our problem, I understand that. And not at some educational level, but deep down in my heart. That my alcoholism and me, I will destroy people. And the healing process of that is magical, because my mom and my relationship with my mom is second to none. You know, my mom, you know, it's like a lot has to do with Chloe. You know, my mom finally realized I met a woman that was really helped me, but I can't say enough for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the healing that happened as a result of that. Going to my brother's grave, you know, like I hadn't been to my brother's grave in 25 years and realizing, like, I got to go, Chloe, we got to go to San Francisco. I got to fly across the country and I need to put flowers on my brother's grave. I need to respect my brother. Because I was the type of guy who, oh, your brother died, you know, what a shame. And I'd like, yeah, well, he didn't know. I didn't know him, so he didn't mean anything to me. And how cold and callous. No respect for him. Never honored my brother. And I had to go and flew to Frisco. My older brother lives there, so we did some of that. And then I took Chloe out to where I grew up, and then we went out to this cemetery, and we found my brother's grave. And it was a huge cemetery. And I went in there. I'll never forget. I went in there, and I said, I need to find a grave. It's probably, I haven't been out here in 25 years at least. I said, he was 7 years old when he died. And she said, oh, then he's in Lullaby Land. And when she said that, it hit me. He was just a kid. He was a baby. I never honored him. And she told me where it was, and we went out. I got quiet. I honored my brother. You know, and you guys did that. You taught me that. And so life goes on, you know. Now I got 2 kids, you know. I look at my daughter when she was born and I realize, you know, I realize at a deeper level of how much damage I really did to my parents. You know, when I see a child, when I look at my daughter, I had never had unconditional love ever in my life. Never. There was always a condition on my love. But with my daughter, it was completely 100% unconditional love. This woman. God. Way ahead of that one. This girl could do no wrong. It don't matter, I will always love her. And then I understood why my mom walked with me. It's the same way. And so I'm forever grateful. I can't take credit for anything that's ever happened. It's strictly me being willing, but only based on pain and fear. And I'll be forever grateful for the men and the women who walk before me and teach me. And know deep in my heart that I have a lot more to learn. Father of 2 now, and I have a son to raise and a daughter to raise. It's my job to teach them how to live life, to show them the way. It's a big undertaking for a guy like me. So, again, I thank Mike for asking me to come up here. It's an honor and a privilege, and I thank you for listening to me. Thanks.
If you'd like to become a member of this group, please see me after the meeting and we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.